Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Paul Howes makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He spoke here before he became that famous, and he spoke here about a year ago, essentially on energy policy, with particular reference to uranium. It was a very important speech. But tonight, Paul Howes is going to speak for us on the topic of Campaign Diary of a Faceless Man. I'll introduce him very briefly. Paul Howes is the National Secretary of the Australian Workers' Union. He's been a union official since the age of 17, and he became the youngest leader of Australia's oldest union, the AWU, in 2007. Paul Howes, of course, is heavily involved in the Labor movement and the Labor Party, but his principal position is as a senior trade union official, and he's just written Confessions of a Faceless Man inside Campaign 2010, and we've got some copies of that for sale after the function. So for now, I'd just like to say, Paul Howes, you're very welcome. Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you, Jared, very much for that kind introduction and for inviting me to speak to the Sydney Institute again. Last time I spoke here, I forgot half my speech and left it in my office. So I hope, I just realised I haven't checked if it's all here, and I hope that my very competent staff that are here with me have made sure the whole thing's here. I'd also like to acknowledge my very good friend, Ed Husick, the member for Greenway, who is here today as well. I appreciate him being here. It's always an honour to address institutions like the Sydney Institute. And I don't always agree with the positions, Jared, that you and the Sydney Institute take, but I respect the intellectual gravitas behind the work you produce. I must say, coming to speak here, I get more than a little jealous of the Liberal Party and of conservative politics generally in Australia that they have the Sydney Institute. Jared, your Sydney Institute provides an amazing platform to provide and promote and discuss ideas. A wonderful platform to talk about different perspectives with the members and supporters of this important think tank. And I wish that those on my side of politics, progressive, social democratic Australian politics, had something to match the Sydney Institute. For a generation or more, here in Australia, we have witnessed a flowering of Tory political culture. We have watched ideas flowing out of places like the Sydney Institute and places like the Institute of Public Affairs in Melbourne. And now I've said the IPA, there's also the H.R. Nichols Society ideas, and the Sydney Institute may propose policies that are abhorrent. These institutions may propose policies that are abhorrent to me as a loyal Labor man, but you've created a culture of ideas to nourish conservative politics. The Sydney Institute has proven its value to the conservative side of politics in this country. Frankly, I am a little jealous of what Jared has done for the Liberal Party. I only wish we could have a similar range of respectable organisations for the Labor side of politics. It is one of the many things that struck me during the recent federal election campaign. Instead of developing Labor values, evolving Labor culture, meeting the new century with brilliant new Labor ideas, we've become reactive. Dare I say it, we've become fundamentalists who will not easily stray away from the Labor orthodox path. Too often nowadays, we can be seen reacting to the ideas pushed forward by Tony Abbott and his allies. Too often nowadays, anyone who dares to question the Labor orthodoxy faces a thousand stone throwing apparatchiks, ready to bury you in the sand up to your neck. Those stone throwers seem to be able to quickly, easily, accurately hit their targets and silence the dissidents. Jared, I've decided I'm going to make it one of my missions over the coming years to ensure we get at least a couple of think tanks to match and best the Sydney Institute. If we are going to do that, then yes, Labor's Faceless Men, a tag which you will see in my book, Confessions of a Faceless Man, I don't feel comfortable with at all, will have to step back a bit and learn to tolerate dissent. We need to promote a culture within the Labor Party that says that it is a good thing to question Labor orthodoxy. There are already a number of think tanks, you could argue, that are loosely associated with the progressive, social democrat, centre-left or Labor side of politics. You've got Per Capita, the Centre for Policy Development, Catalyst, the Australia Institute, the Earth Foundation and the Fabians. There's a lot of shingles blowing in the wind. They all claim the progressive, social democrat, Labor values think tank label. But frankly, none of them are as healthy, have as much gravitas and community standing as those on the conservative side of the political fence. For me, it is hard to admit this, but it's simply a fact. The former state Labor Minister, Rod Cavalier, has recently issued his own analysis of Labor's problems. I must say that I don't agree with his conclusions, especially about the role of unions in the Labor Party. However, it is very good that he's written his book and is promoting ideas and debate. I don't want to pretend that Confessions of a Faceless Man is an ideas book in the vein of Rod Cavalier's. It plainly isn't. It is a diary of the different highs and lows that I felt through this last federal election campaign. And I even take a few pot shots at Rod in my diary. But that's mainly because I do not believe that in an election environment, especially as tight as the one we just faced, we need focus and discipline. I think Rod and a couple of other Labor elders forgot the importance of discipline in elections. The prime example of that, of course, is Mark Latham. But then maybe he's lost the right to be claimed to be called a Labor elder because of his nutbag behaviour over the last few years, and more especially during the election campaign. That does not mean, outside of a heated election environment, Rod and others should not question the sacred cows. We should get people talking about new ideas for the Labor movement and what exactly are Labor values in a 21st century context. Throughout the federal election campaign, as I observed the highs and the lows, I painfully felt that one of our big problems is that we've lost our ability to generate ideas. Ideas and values that touch people and make them get excited about being Labor supporters. This wasn't a flash of revelation just because of the federal election campaign. But in the heat of an election battle, to be very truthful, it does become starkly obvious that Labor was not promoting a whole raft of new ideas to promote a social democratic Australia. Too often, we were just reacting to Tony Abbott and his Conservative mates. As I note in my diary, Labor could do worse than to learn from the experience of John Howard's Prime Ministership. While I find just about everything that he stood for and did in office to be reprehensible, he did understand power, the electorate, and how to affect change. No one can deny that during his 11 years in office, he radically changed the power structures in this country to ensure that his conservative agenda was adopted. He did it through incremental changes and by taking the electorate with him. He showed courage and the moral backbone to stand up for his beliefs. That is the challenge for Australian Labor. Affecting change to make our society more equal, prosperous and progressive, and bringing the electorate with us as we do it. So, Jared, you and the Institute have got to take at least some of the credit for the way John Howard affected change in this country. It was the ideas that think tanks like yours generated and over the years got to the Australian public and the Liberal Party leadership to accept that ensured those Howard successes. Now, on the Labor side, our lack of ideas generation is a problem. I've discussed this a number of times with one of my great mates in the Labor Party, Bob Carr. Carr, like me, is despairing of what's happened to the Labor Party over the last few decades. As the youngster, Carr sat at the feet of great people with ideas, people who knew why they were in the Labor Party, what they were fighting for, and ready to discuss those values and pass them on to the next generation. The young Labour right of Bob Carr's time was set afire by one of my heroes and my predecessor, Laurie Short. Short was in the Labour movement campaigning for clear values. He wanted to ensure that Stalinist thugs did not capture the union movement and in turn get influence and control over the ALP. If you don't believe me that there was a real threat from the Stalinists, just take the time to read Mark Aaron's fascinating history of his family in the Communist Party of Australia, The Family File. Now, if I have problems sometimes with Gerard on my right, I also have problems with Mark Aaron's on my left. I don't agree with his analysis of me in the August edition of The Monthly. Nor do I have much time for Mark Latham's comments about my union and our views on climate change in the latest edition of The Monthly. But I found Mark Aaron's history of the communists in Australia through the lens of his family's ASIO's files fascinating. It showed how correct the Labor right was when they campaigned to protect our party from the influence of the Stalinists. Bob Carr and I have chatted many times about our despair that the young Labor right has no sense of this extraordinary history, a history that really informed our values for 50 years or more. The truth is that many people in my section of the Labor Party don't actually know why they are members of the right. They don't have a sense of our history and really can't stand up and argue for our values and ideas. Now, I'm also sure that there are people in the Labor left honest enough to say the same goes for members of the Labor left. It might be easier for me to say this as I'm yet to make 30. If Carr, who is twice my age, said it, they might accuse him of just being a grumpy, fuddy-duddy old man living in the past. To be honest, both the Labor left and the Labor right have lost that ability to argue for our values and to generate new ideas to inform those values. That's why I've discussed with Bob and a number of other Labor people about the need to send off our young people to re-education camps. Not the Stalinist types, though. I want us to teach them about our proud history, and then to tell them to run with that history, and run with that history with some courage. I want young Labor people to take those values out into the community, put forward new ideas based on our historic values, and to listen to the responses. There is an increasing tendency now for political activists just to talk to themselves. Membership in political parties, Labor and Liberal, have taken a dive. Those who still attend their local party branch meetings for both Labor and Liberal are increasingly only retirees. Only some of Labor branches regularly meeting in... Some of the Labor branches regularly meeting in the same drafty halls are still debating the split. Many political activists, union officials, don't often attend their own suburban branch meeting. And I'll put my hand up. I admit that it has been years, possibly 8 years, since I walked into a meeting of my local ALP branch. And I'm not interested in ever going over the meaning of the split again and again and again, and debating whether we'll meet on a Sunday morning to stop Catholics from coming to a branch meeting. Smaller and smaller numbers of people are talking to each other about political values and political ideas. Not only do we have to educate our base about the history of our values and how we evolve those values into new political ideas, but we also need to be ready to take those values and ideas out to a wider public, discuss them, and carefully listen to the responses. The leadership of the Labor Party must adopt and promote a strategy of breaking out of the Labor corridors of power. That doesn't mean just using Twitter, Facebook, or some social networking site. We've got to be ready to go out and have our ideas challenged. Go out amongst the wider community. Take new ideas out. Discuss them freely. Have them challenged. And accepting this challenge will have an important role the future of the ALP. It will end the fear I sometimes sense inside the party. It will develop a new intellectual courage amongst Labor people to stand up to the orthodoxy, stand up to the Labor machine, and, in course, end the myth of the so-called faceless men controlling the party. In turn, my mates who work in my office building in Sussex Street have got to accept the right to openly, fearlessly debate ideas. Just because some of these new ideas don't fit in with the current orthodoxy, the leadership shouldn't sandbag Sussex Street against those who want to discuss new ideas. I don't want to shut people up. Shutting people up turns our natural constituency away from us. It turns our base in suburban working Australia off politics. It keeps people who should be eager, our eager supporters, out of the very democratic process which would best improve their lives. I don't want Labor to end up in the inner suburbs political ghetto when we are just manning the barricades against the green hordes. The majority of Australians are not in the inner cities. They are in the suburbs and the regional centres outside of Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. It is in the suburbs and the regional centres where Australian Workers' Union members and their families live. And I want to ensure that my members, their families and their neighbours continue to see Labor as their natural home, because they continue to see Labor as a party which delivers them a better life for them, for their families and for their neighbours. John Howard, the Sydney Institute, developed the ideas which stole Labor's natural base away from us. Jared, fair warning here, I want those Labor people to come back and challenge those ideas. I want new pro-Labor think tanks and our wider community base to compete in the marketplace of ideas, to get people excited again about our agenda to improve the lives of my union's members, their families and their neighbours. Thank you.
Many thanks, Paul House. We've got some copies of Confessions of a Faceless Man inside the campaign 2010, and I'm sure Mr. House would be happy to sign them. I'm reflecting that when we opened the doors of the Sydney Institute in 1989, Paul House was not quite 8 years old, I think. So I don't know what it says about us or him, probably about both of us. Can I just lead off questions and discussion? You mentioned tonight that you don't want the Labor Party to be warding off what you call the green hordes. But as you recall in your many appearances on Sky News during the campaign and in your column in the Sunday Telegraph, you yourself were quite concerned about the influence of the Greens. And I'm just wondering, when you talk about your members being in the outer suburbs and the regional centres as they are, you've also got now to deal with this what is called an agreement or an alliance between Labor and the Greens that was signed after the election. As a confession of a not-so-faceless man, I mean, do you think that was sound politics? Was that kind of agreement or alliance necessary? Can you cope with that in the lead up to the next election?
As the launcher of my book would say, whatever it takes, and whatever it takes to form government, I think is important. And certainly, I would much rather Labor be in bed with the Greens and be in government than Labor be ideologically pure and in opposition. And I think that there is certainly a growing challenge for Labor from the Greens. I think that sometimes that challenge is overblown. I think the Greens are a party which rely incredibly much on their leader, and I don't think their leader will be around forever. I think the contradictions that exist within the Greens, particularly between the watermelons, your Lee Rhiannons of the world, and your avocados, your Bob Browns of the world, will become very, very clear when Bob Brown does step down as the leader of the Greens, because As I have said, and I think you've said as well, Jared, and I think we're both jointly attacked for saying, I don't believe people like Lee Rhiannon are in fact true Greens. I think they are people who, in the post-Cold War environment, have been looking for a political home where they can continue to espouse their socialist, communist, Stalinist agenda, and were looking for a vehicle to do that within, and they found it within the Greens. Now, I started my life on the far left. I've never hidden from that. Big difference between myself and Lee Rhiannon, who did also start her life on the far left, is that when I moved into organisations that aren't from the far left, I also admitted my past mistakes and my past, the fact that the ideology that I previously held was wrong. I've never heard Lee Rhiannon ever do that. And in fact, when she defends her involvement, particularly in the Socialist Party of Australia and after the split of the Communist Party, I've never heard her ever repudiate that organisation's defence of the crimes of the Stalinist regimes in Eastern Europe in particular. That being said, don't get me started on Lee Rhiannon, I start too much on that, but I think that there's some massive contradictions in the Greens that will become clear in the coming years. I also think they have never had to be in a position where they've actually had to govern responsibly, make hard decisions, and that will test them greatly. I think the fact that you saw Sarah Hanson-Young challenging Christine Milne for the deputy leadership of the Greens, and the Greens went to extraordinary lengths to keep that secret and out of public knowledge for several weeks, shows that some of the party elders in that party are concerned about the coming debates. That being said, I also think that Labor needs to provide a reason for our traditional base in progressive circles in the inner cities to still vote for us. We can't. If we say to people in the inner city, "Well, listen, you can vote Green and you can still get a Labor government," then we will be giving away seats into the future, seats, important seats that will be needed to form government. I notice in my own suburb of Leichhardt, friends of mine who would be traditional Labor voters and, you know, upwardly mobile but progressive people that wouldn't be comfortable with the full extent of the Greens' economic policies in particular, voting Green at the last election because I thought that Labor was not providing clear leadership on the progressive issues that they would expect a Labor Party to take leadership on. And that's why I was referring to the way Howard governed. I think what Labor needs to do is learn to embrace our core beliefs, to satisfy our inner city progressive base, but equally make sure we're providing leadership to our traditional working class base in the suburbs and demonstrating that, in fact, we are the party that will make their lives better. And it's easier said than done, but I think the way that you do that is through the generation of ideas, and I think that's what our party hasn't been doing over the last period, particularly since 2007.
Well, we've got plenty of time and plenty of questions. So we've got Lindsay. Yep. Then we go to Alison. Yes, Lindsay.
You spoke about confessions and recanting. I want to give you the opportunity.
Now, speak up just a bit, will you, for our podcast here.
You spoke about confessions and recanting. I want to give you the opportunity in this friendly forum. And you introduced your speech by talking about intellectual gravitas and contrast that with stone throwing out the parachutes. As Jared said, you write and you appear regularly on television, and that presumably reflects the fact that as an insider, you know more than most of us. For 5 weeks, you made the regular comment that you thought Tony Abbott was the Mark Latham of the Liberal Party. And in light of the reduction in the Labor primary vote, it might be suggested that Julia Gillard was the Mark Latham of the Labor Party. Does that comment, would you like to recant that or tell us why you made it or confess that you were just a stone-throwing parachute?
Oh, when I was bagging stone throwing apparatchiks, I was including myself in it. I revel in throwing stones. It's what I do best. But no, I don't think I'm wrong on that. And frankly, what I didn't like about Mark Latham when he was leading our party was that I thought he was taking our party in a direction which was away from what we should be actually doing. I remember the Tasmanian Forest decision in particular, and his lack of regard for the workers that would be affected by that decision, his lack of regard for consulting with the union that represents those workers, the fact that he was simply sucking up to the green vote by going down there and making that decision and thinking that we would pick up seats like Wentworth and Sydney, I think was a huge mistake and was, in my view, a fundamental betrayal of core Labor values. If I was a member of the Liberal Party, and if I was thinking what motivates someone to be a member of the Liberal Party, I would believe in a few things, I reckon. Free enterprise, commerce, that the markets essentially are a force for good, and that small government is better than big government in promoting markets and free enterprise. Now, I do not believe that Tony stands for free enterprise, for a reduction of government intervention, for the markets essentially being able to resolve issues. They would, if they weren't, you wouldn't have the bizarre populist rhetoric coming out of the coalition that's coming at the moment regarding the banks. Some of these statements, that Joe, particularly the statements he was making, Joe Hockey made 2 weeks ago in that speech about the banks, I mean, that is stuff that I would have heard people with Scottish accents at an ALP national conference saying a couple of years ago. I mean, you have and that, in my mind, if I was a, you know, core Liberal voter, I'd be aghast by that. It's like if I was a core Liberal voter or a core Liberal branch member, how could you be happy with a leader of your state party who votes against the privatisation of the electricity generators and also votes to make it a crime to publish school league tables, not even against school league tables, votes to make it a crime to publish school league tables, which is what Barry O'Farrell did. Now, that is... I can't see how Barry Farrell sits in the tradition of the Liberal Party. I can't see how Tony Abbott does. I think... I don't think I'm being crass in saying this. I think Tony Abbott's natural home would be in the DLP. And if you think about many of the economic policies that he is espousing at the moment, you can read a very good book, which I finished reading a couple of weeks ago, which is the collection of correspondence of B.A. Santa Maria. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating read, and I encourage you all to read it. But you can, when you read that correspondence, you certainly know where this right-wing populist rhetoric, which is coming out at the moment regarding the economy, stems from.
Ellison.
You suggested that it's, I think, more complicated than it really is. In 2007, the electorate made very clear what they wanted from Labor if they were going to give Labor government after the long, hard years. They made it very clear what they wanted. In 2010, the electorate punished Labor for not giving it to them. It's very easy and simple to understand what those things are, I suppose. And I don't think you need more focus groups, and I don't think you need re-education camps to get it. If you don't get it, then it's not a matter of going back to values or basic principles or anything. Just look at what the people said twice. And if you didn't get it then, you're going to get it from state elections, one after the other. They'll tell you again.
Okay.
I see.
Yes, but I think it's not as easy as being said as being done. I mean, this was the issue. If you think about, let's take one issue from 07, climate change, okay, for example. Now, clearly there was a very strong message from the electorate that the people of Australia wanted action on climate change. They wanted action on climate change. Now, having action on climate change and developing an incredibly complex new market in the form of an ETS, or creating a carbon tax, or taking action through government regulation are all very different things. The reason why I think Labor failed to deliver an ETS, but also to properly articulate to the Australian people why this form of an ETS was important, was because, one, we were relying solely on the orthodoxy of the CPRS as it was drafted, and there was no ability for us as a movement to debate the different options that maybe needed to be adopted to go forward. There was no debate in the party about it. No, we said climate change is bad, got to stop climate change. without actually realising that addressing climate change is an incredibly complex procedure and an incredibly complex process, and actually developing the ideas and the policies and the debate internally requires us to be more open to internal dissent. And I can tell you, there may have been many Liberals who wanted to vote against the CPRS. I can tell you there were many Labor people, many, many members of the Labor caucus who wanted to vote against the CPRS as well, because we didn't have that culture of ideas. We didn't have that culture of debate. There was no forum for the caucus to articulate those views in. I think you're right. If we don't take that type of action, then the electorate will punish Labor again. But the only way we'll be able to take that type of action and have those big reforms and show that leadership is if we actually foster a culture where those ideas can be put forward and accepted and even disagreed with in a forum without being punished, as people were during that period of 07, from 07 onwards. In terms of the state governments, I think we can pretty much guarantee that the voters of many states are going to punish Labor regardless of what happens at a federal level at some upcoming state elections. And I don't know if there will be much lessons to be drawn from those electoral results, particularly here in March next year for the federal government, because I think you're dealing with a very whole different set of issues here.
You're only potentially
Penelope Nelson, okay? Yep. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what those historic Labor values are that you refer to, and whether moving back to them involves moving away from the increasingly conservative positions that the federal Labor leadership has taken on things like economics and social policy. Are those positions, especially things like, you know, claiming to be the new economic conservatives, as Rudd did, are they at odds with the historic Labor values that you're practicing?
Well, I don't know. Economic conservative means, I don't think it means anything other than a slogan for both parties. But in terms of those values, the values that I think about, why am I a member of the moderate wing of the Labor movement? Because I believe in democracy. I believe in equality. I believe that markets, when appropriately regulated and harnessed, can be an enormous force for good. So it's not an anti-market message. And I believe that working people do better when they're joined together than when they're divided, and I believe that we have more in common with each other than we, you know, than some may try to perpetrate. And I think the moderate wing of my party, for example, someone like Laurie Short, who was a viewed as a conservative within the Labor movement, I think did far more to deal with refugees and the post-war influx than any other so-called leftist leader of the union movement. I think that he did more to ensure there was equality for working people in those areas. And I think that Labor needs to... when I'm talking about those ideas and those values for, you know, young Labor activists, I think that's important, because it is, you know, there is a culture of forgetting why you're in certain factions. And, you know, the faction that I'm in never talks about the role that we played in defeating communism in this country and why communism was, in fact, a real threat to this country, and accept the Labor, and too often we accept the left orthodoxy that, in fact, the groupers, the industrial groups, and some people that end up splitting to the DLP, but others that stayed and fought the fight within the party, too often we accept the view that's been perpetrated by the left that, in fact, there's a whole bunch of McCarthyism going on in Australia. Mark Aaron's book proves that, in fact, people like Laurie Short and John Ducker, and even, dare I say, B.A. Santa Maria, were right, that there was people who were taking orders from a party that was controlled by a foreign power in the Labor ministry, and that was a concerning thing. How we translate that through to today is that those people in that grouping had the moral fortitude to stand up and fight for what they actually believed in, and that's what's missing out of political culture today in Labor. I recently, a couple of days ago, came out and I said that I think that Labor needs to dump its nonsensical position on gay marriage. Now, that is not a position that someone in my union, that someone in my position previously would ever say, and certainly, even if they believed it, would never say it because it's the traditional roles. But I think that if Laurie Short was alive today and still the secretary of the FIA or the AWU, he would advocate a similar position, because he would see this as a form of discrimination that's become widely accepted in society that needs to be fought on, and that's, I think, the type of conversations we need to have to guarantee the movement's future.
Just as an aside, this audience is probably more politically diverse than you've assumed in your speech. But my question is, many parliamentarians have a union background. Do you have parliamentary ambitions yourself? And if so, has this book helped or hindered them?
I've been the secretary of the AWU for 3 years. I intend to continue to do this for many years in the future. As I've said many times before, I don't have a great desire to enter Parliament, but I'm not going to rule anything out. I probably think if I was betting, I'd say I'm not going to, because, frankly, I've been involved working full-time in the Labor movement since I was 17, and it can get a bit tiring after a while. And in terms of helping or hindering, I don't think that this current book is any great assistance for me at all if I ever wanted to enter federal parliament, particularly in the next little while, because, frankly, I think I've been a little bit too honest about my views than would be politically acceptable if you're wanting to enter the caucus.
Stuart,
Just with the other hat on, how do you think that the Fair Work Act is vetting now?
Fair?
Question about how the fair work.
It's fair. It's not great, not bad, fair. If you listen to people like Steve Knott from the Australian Mines and Metals Association, the world as we know it has ended. The means of production have been nationalised, and the wheels of capitalism have ground to a halt. But really, you haven't seen an increase in industrial action. You have seen an increase in union density, but you haven't seen that increase in union density tied to any increasing in mindless militancy. And what that demonstrates to me is that there are a lot of people who wanted to join a union but were afraid to do so under the previous regime. That's certainly what our experience in the AWU has been since the Fair Work Act has come into advent. I think there were some major issues with award modernisation. I certainly wasn't happy with the process, but that being said, it had to happen eventually, and whoever was going to do it was always going to end up with some people unhappy, because when you're taking such a huge, complex industrial system and streamlining it down, someone's going to lose. Unfortunately, I think too many times the workers lost rather than bosses who could afford to lose, but that's, I think, not a huge impost. There are, from a union point of view, many aspects of the Fair Work Act which are, I think, unnecessarily draconian. And the lack of movement in the abolition of the Australian Building and Construction Commission and coercive powers of that commission, I think, is a huge piece of unfinished business for the labour movement. I think there are some incredibly unjustifiable restrictions on bargaining rights of trade unions in particular. I think my view is that an employer and employees should be able to bargain about whatever they want within the employment relationship. And they shouldn't have restrictions placed upon them simply because of, to be honest, decisions that were taken in the course of an election campaign in 2007 to make Labor look a bit more politically palatable to the employers. And I think when I hear, in the media sometimes the outrage of mining companies and oil companies about growing their power. The irony is I speak to mining company CEOs and oil company CEOs every day. I'm yet to have a single CEO of a major oil company or a major mining company raise any concerns with me about industrial relations. Now, they'll talk to me about infrastructure. They'll talk to me about taxation regimes. They'll talk to me about state and federal government bureaucracy and red tape. But IR is way, way, way down the agenda.
There's a question here. Go down the back here.
What are the characteristics of the faceless man or woman in politics or in any other context, and what would be the opposite type of characteristics?
I don't think a faceless man actually exists. I put the title to kind of poke fun at it, but I think a few people have taken it too literally. I chose the title because I'm regularly bagged for being a media whore, and maybe I am. But at the same time, bagged for being a faceless man. The faceless, there were faceless men. Lazy journalists have continued to perpetuate this line that you know, the current generation of faceless men. Jared will tell you about the real faceless men. You know, the real faceless men of, what was it, 1966?
1963.
Where you have Arthur Caldwell and Gough Whitlam standing outside the
Kingston Hotel
waiting for the federal executive of the Labor Party to make a decision about what the Labor Party's decision on Vietnam would be. They were faceless men. I admire them greatly. The reality is, shortly after that happening, particularly when Gough Whitlam became the leader of the Labor Party, those structures were changed and the caucus became the supreme decision-making body for parliamentary policy. And in fact, the leader of the party sits on the National Executive. Those sorts of issues were removed. So I don't actually think there are such things as faceless men. And in fact, I think what happened, as I write in the book, very honestly, my union did make a decision about supporting Julia Gillard. We articulated that decision publicly. But we have made a decision about our view on the leadership of the Labor Party in every single leadership change since 1891. We've been affiliated to ALP since 1891. We've been in existence since 1886. And every leadership change that's happened since, and ones that didn't happen but we wanted to happen, we've made a view on. The difference was this time, you had a first-term Prime Minister. But remember this. At 9 o'clock, Julia Gillard announced formally that she was challenging for the leadership of the Labor Party. By 9 a.m, 12 hours later, Kevin Rudd could muster at most 18 votes out of a caucus of 117, I think. You would have to have a lot of faceless men doing a lot of faceless work to be able to get those types of numbers in that short period of time. And I can tell you, it didn't happen, because for most of those 12 hours, I was asleep.
Yes.
Paul, it was good to hear you put out the values and as a member of the Labor Party and a happy member of the Sydney Institute. The question I have, someone who would be described by the former Prime Minister as an enterprise worker, about 2.5 million independent contractors, family businesses, and there's a lot of underemployment in that group. And so I'd like to get your views as an ideas man about how, you know, we all work for a living, we're part of the working families, and how you see the Labor Party us representing that group in a modern way.
Well, that's a really, really important point, and it's a really, really big struggle for not just the Labor Party, but more importantly, in my view, the union movement. That changing nature of work. The traditional union response to that type of changing nature of work is opposition. Opposition, and then if we lose, continuing to be opposed and saying, well, we were right all along and we're still opposed. We can't operate like that anymore. There is a lot of sham contracting that exists in this country, and there are a lot of unscrupulous employers who use sham contracting arrangements to undermine employment conditions in this country. But there are a lot of legitimate independent contractors who like being independent contractors, who don't consider themselves employers or, you know, upwardly mobile or the elite. They consider themselves working class people, and how unions deal with those types of people is a big challenge, because it's outside the traditional employment relationship in which unions normally engage. Some unions have done a reasonable job at getting those people. Ed Husic used to be the national president of the CEPU, which covered lots of workers, including electricians, and I think a lot of electricians, independent contractors, are unionised. But often those independent contractors will be almost solely engaged in working for Energy Australia. And I know the Transport Workers Union has done a good job in organising truck drivers who are independent contractors through collective bargaining arrangements for them. We've tried to do a similar thing for chicken farmers, who are, you know, self-employed. Arguably, shearers are self-employed as well, that don't fall within that traditional employment relationship the way that most shearers operate today, as opposed to how they used to. How are we going to acknowledge workers? I don't know.
Does the FSU struggle to deal with that?
The FSU struggle, and
it's been a good struggle, I'm not criticising, yeah. It's been very difficult.
But the FSU is finance sector union. Okay. APESMA, the Association of Professional Engineers, Scientists and Managers Australia, and unions like the Australian Services Union with their white-collar areas, I don't envy that job. I don't envy the job that those unions have in organising those types of workers. I feel very fortunate to be representing a traditional blue-collar, heavy industry union where it is relatively easy to organise workers. I know that those unions are looking at straight ways to do it. APESMA in particular, under the new leadership of Chris Walton, are working at new organising techniques. I know the FSU has as well. But I don't think there's an easy answer to it because, I view a union membership as a relationship between the union and the worker, and the member expects something in return. And too often in those independent contracting arrangements, it's hard to know what the service the independent contractor gets for being a part of the union. So that's why many unions think, oh, well, the solution is re-regulation of the workforce, making that illegal and, you know, centralised wage fixation. But, you know, we've got to live with the new realities of the changing nature of work. And we can't just sit back and say, oh, it's too hard, because if we do, we're just basically saying that we're going to die a long and slow, painful death.
Okay, so there's a question here, and
we
go here, and
we
go here. Yeah.
Paul, there's a general feeling out in the community that Labor has lost touch with its roots. And I actually saw that on Q&A the other night when a traditional Labor voter expressed a terrific disappointment at Bill Shorten about the way Labor was going. What do you think of the proposition that in contemporary Labor is very top-heavy with careerist politicians, that have come up through the union movement or through Labor administration and have become isolated from the coalface of the Australian workplace?
I find this debate about union officials being out of touch with normal society extraordinary, because I've got to tell you, I reckon Bill, my predecessor, I used to be his deputy, probably doesn't see as much of the Australian workplace as he used to when he had my job. When he had my job, I know he did, because I know what I do every day and I know what he did every day. In fact, I can think of very few jobs like mine where you actually do have to, on a daily basis, deal with rank-and-file workers in precarious employment conditions, people that are living in this country in poverty, and then also deal with CEOs and come and speak to people like yourself and give presentations like this, but then tomorrow go and do more mass meetings, go out to communities, door knock and talk. I mean, the thing about being a union official, and it's our problem, we've created this perception because we haven't dispelled the myths effectively enough. I know what union officials do every day, and it's not sitting around in Chinese restaurants plotting and planning. We only do that on Fridays. The rest of the time, and look, there is a bit of that, you know, there is a bit of that, but, you know, we're membership organisations. If we were sitting around in ivory towers, doing nothing and plotting and planning, my members wouldn't be members, or they wouldn't vote for me, and I'd either have no job or the union wouldn't have any money. Our union, 97% of our income comes from membership fees. So that means we need to be out on the coalface on a daily basis, demonstrating to our 135,000 members that we are relevant to their lives and they should remain members. And I have been to, I reckon, just about every corner of this country, in just about every industry, in the most bizarre workplaces and the most normal workplaces. And if I hadn't been a union official, if I had been, if I hadn't left the finance sector where I worked before as a bank teller, I would never have had that type of experience. I'd be very good in knowing how to reconcile my till, though. So I don't agree with that perception about union officials. And I also think that some of the most effective and dynamic and interesting leaders, and not just the formal leader, but leading people in our party, have come from the union movement. And when I think about the most effective leaders, most of them were union officials before they entered Parliament. Paul Keating, working for the MEU, Bob Hawke, of course, the ACTU, John Curtin, Ben Chifley. These are the iconic images, you know, here in New South Wales. People like... I've got a mental block all of a sudden. Bekel, sorry. You know, Boilermaker, active in his union, and became, you know, and changed the way that Labor operated in New South Wales by repairing the party after the damage of the late years. But I do accept, one of the arguments I do accept from Rodney Cavalier's book is that Labor needs to widen its space. The branch structure doesn't work. Rank and file people who don't want to become union officials and don't want to become apparatchiks should be able to get pre-selection. And they shouldn't have to be stars to get it, or celebrities to get it. And the way we need to do that is by transforming the way that our branches work, by actually making it people able to participate in the decision-making process of the party. And I think there is... I listened to Carl Batar's speech on Wednesday intently... Tuesday intently, sorry. There were some very interesting words coming from, you know, the ultimate faceless man there about the need to open up our party and decision-making processes. But I've got to say, when I do look around the caucus and I think about some of our most ordinary MPs, they're often the ones who weren't apparatchiks, who weren't union officials, and got in by default. I mean, there is actually some... Yesterday, Michael Kroger, when he was launching my book, was talking about this question of celebrity candidates. He was running an argument that essentially Rudd failed because he was an outsider. And he was talking about other outsiders who have failed, and in his main line there was John Hewson for his party. And he said, politics is actually a profession. It is a profession where the longer you operate in it, the better you get. And that's important to remember as well. So I think our future is a hybrid, widening our pool of people that can come in, but not also just saying, well, some of these people have been disasters, therefore we'll get rid of all of them. You know.
Going to finish at 7, and I've called two people, so here. Third last question, second last question. Yeah.
Thank you, Paul. The question and the observations in a constructive manner. Listening to your regrets about the ALP's production of new ideas and the timing, how long that's been the case, it seems to me we go back to about where Bob Carr was sitting at the feet of his mentor, which is about the time of your entering the workforce. So am I right in saying that that your regrets about the Labor Party's production of new ideas is about your entire time working in the union movement, the political movement, and therefore was your attraction to the Labor Party really from an historical perspective?
It was the longest short question we've had at the Sydney Institute this year. It's a good question, but it's just a brief answer.
No. I think Labor, the period that I think we've struggled with is the 07 to now period. The reason why I think that's the case is that I think Labor learnt through 11 years that you needed to be a disciplined opposition to convince the Australian people to entrust you with government. They did that very well in the lead up to 07. The mistake we made is that we thought we had to maintain that Kim Il-sung-like discipline for the entire time. So for 3 years, ideas were sucked like a vacuum out of the party. And the capacity for individuals to think independently and to debate ideas independently equally was sucked out. And if you did dare raise your hand, I can tell you what that ton of bricks felt like. And it came straight from Kirribilli House. I experienced it. I know Ed experienced it. It's amazing Ed's in Parliament because of the way that we were, if we dared question orthodoxy, you were gone.
For the
record, okay. All right, it's
there. Quick, yeah. Very quickly, the ALP has got a review panel to deal with the anger about the way that they conducted the election, which is just as I understand it, Steve Bratz, but also John Faulkner, a person who was a supporter of Mark Latham, which one of the issues of the ability of caucus to actually even identify the failings of their own members, and Bob Carr, who we may find has got great ideas, but has been a supporter, outspoken supporter of issues such as spin and mark-up div and the areas that are often the point of criticism about the way the ALP conducted its campaign. How is this review going to be conducted, and how is it going to affect the change we've talked about?
Bob Carr's the longest serving premier this state's ever had in a single course. He was an incredibly successful politician. Like him or love him, he knew how to win elections and make a successful Labor Party. So I have no issue with Bob being on it. Steve Bracks equally, that magnificent victory in 1999 against Kennett, which surprised us all. I remember being down there as a young Labor volunteer thinking, you know, I thought we'd go to the lost party and, oh my God, we won government. John Faulkner, I'll say this about John Faulkner. Yes, he was a supporter of Mark Latham, but John Faulkner has been a supporter of every leader of the party, and he has done a magnificent service for Labor because he... It's good to know journalists here, because I can say, he's like the psychiatric nurse of the Labor Party, you know, going along and making sure the mad people are kept in train and doing, I tell you, a god-awful job. But he is, I think you'd be hard-pressed. He's in a different faction, I mean, not from my tradition. You'd be hard-pressed to find a man of more integrity or fortitude of character than you would in John Faulkner.
Just a final brief question, a brief response. Your book is not merely a diary, but it's essentially a diary. So obviously you made up your mind around the time the campaign started that you were going to write this book. So what was the aim at that time, and what do you think your book's achieved?
I decided to write the book several weeks before the campaign was launched, mainly because I thought this would be an interesting election campaign. I thought it's important to document it. I don't think we have enough political diaries in Australian political life. I remember one of the best political diaries I've ever read was Steve Vizard's diary of the Republican convention, something that I was too young to kind of remember in great detail, but it was great to read about now. So I think Labor people should do this. We should write about what happens, be open and say that we do have a lot of warts and, you know, we're not all happy families. But equally, I want to foster a culture in our party where people aren't afraid to speak out. I am fortunate that I'm in one of the very few positions in the Labor Party where I can speak out with any great fear of any consequences. Not many other people can, but I think if I create a forum where people can, then others will do the same. And in terms of achievements, it's been out since Monday. Hopefully it's achieved some sales. Hopefully it's achieved some debate. And hopefully it will make sure that those within our movement who committed crimes that are unparalleled, that make people like Vince Gare look like saints, will be remembered for years and years to come.
Many thanks.
Well, I know there were more questions, but we always finish on time. So, and we did do a lot of questions. I'll be very brief. I was always a great admirer of Laurie Short that Paul House has referred to in his speech, and it was Laurie who introduced me to Bill Shorten, and quite a some time later it was Bill Shorten at a function down in Melbourne where I met him at a party who told me about this great young talent he had in his union who he was certain in a few years' time would take over, which is Paul House. And Paul is a very impressive Australian, and it's great to have him back at the Sydney Institute this time for the second time. I'm sure he'll be back again in the future. But this is an important book, Confessions of a Faceless Man. It's achieved a considerable publicity in the brief time it's out because it's got a significant message. And some will agree with it, some will disagree with it, but it's certainly worth reading from both sides of politics' point of view. So I'll just be very quick and wind up to say well done, thanks a lot, and we'll see you back in the future. Varenne's got some copies of Confessions of a Faceless Man. I'm sure Paul will be happy to sign them. Thanks for coming.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.